Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram time.
It's 5:59.
Like WSKV-FM on Facebook.
Pickup Country.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us tonight on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV for our new and exciting Pick Me a Story series, where you'll embark on a journey through the pages of different stories read aloud by featured librarians from the Powell County Public Library. You can tune in live right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, listen online or on demand at listenlikealocal.com with our free mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcast. My name is Kelly Ward, and I am the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library. I'll be reading all kinds of different books to you from different genres, like sci-fi and fantasy, westerns, mysteries, and more. Be healthy at home with the whole family and enjoy this storytelling service provided by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and the Powell County Public Library. Pick Me a Story will be every Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on your hometown station, and we're so excited you can join us tonight. Let's get started. So, last week we left off with Molly Brown's short story, The Selene Gardening Society. In the story so far, we've been introduced to Evangelina Maston, our main protagonist, who is a high-class lady and a member of the New Park Ladies Gardening Society. This story takes place in 19th century Baltimore, and in this world, the streets are overflowing with an excess of garbage. So much so that the New Park Ladies Gardening Society, consisting of Evangelina, Fiona Wick, the club's president, Hermione Larkin, the club's vice president, and others, has made it their mission to launch all of Baltimore's garbage to the moon. We left off last week in a heated argument between the Gardening Society ladies and the militarized council of men and husbands in charge of making the final call for the moon expedition. Will the gardening ladies make history with revolutionizing a new method of composting on the moon? And will Evangelina be able to take back ownership of her garden, which was taken over by her unemployed husband? This is The Selene Gardening Society by Molly Brown. A garden on the moon, Mr. Barbicane said wistfully. If only it were possible. Fiona's eyebrows shot up in surprise. Even Captain Nichols seemed a little startled. But it is possible, Fiona protested, sifting through her notes. There's much more I haven't gone into yet. Bees, for example. I didn't mention the bees because they don't come in until a later stage. And there'll be worms. Lots of worms. My dear Mrs. Wick, I am sure that your idea is more than possible in theory. It's just impossible in practice. But the one thing you have not considered is, how on earth do you expect to send all these missiles to the moon? But you've done it before, Fiona sputtered. The Columbiad cannon. The cannon to which you refer fired one projectile containing three men, two dogs, and a handful of chickens towards the moon on one occasion, more than 20 years ago. Firing that one, comparatively lightweight, missile, one time only, required 400,000 pounds of fulminating cotton. What you are proposing would seem to involve the firing of an immense number of much heavier projectiles, on a daily basis over a period of many years, possibly a century or more. I doubt there is that much explosive in the world, and even if there was, the cost would be prohibitive. Fiona scoured her pages of notes, searching for an answer. But the cannon still exists, said Evangelina. Barbicane shook his head. Melted down years ago. And Moon City? Fiona asked, referring to the Florida base the gun club had constructed for that one long-ago trip to the moon. Long since reclaimed by jungle, said Barbicane. There was no reason to maintain it. Fiona turned an imploring gaze to Captain Nichol. The captain responded with a sympathetic shrug. What is going on here? J.T. Maston demanded, slamming his good fist down on the table. When did Impey Barbicane ever fail to rise to a challenge? When did Captain Nickel ever withdraw from the prospect of difficulty with a shrug? These are not the men I know. The men I know do not retreat from problems. They thrive on them. Calm down, Maston, said Mr. Barbicane. I merely said it was impossible. I never said we wouldn't find a way to do it. That evening, Evangelina sat down at her roll-top desk to compose an overseas cablegram. Scorbitt House, New Park, Baltimore. Dear Monsieur Ardan, we have never met, but my husband has always said he considers you the best of men, and I thought you would want to know what is happening here in Baltimore. Chapter 6. The Great Work Begins and a Cablegram Arrives. Over the next few weeks, a company was formed, workers were hired, and rubbish collection contracts were signed with cities up and down the eastern coast of America. A team was dispatched to the Florida wilderness to begin the rebuilding of Moon City. The ladies of the Gardening Society worked on refining their designs for the Selenite Garden. Barbicane and Nickel attacked the problem of the explosives, and J.T. Maston spent his days and nights at the chalkboard, covering it in strange arithmetical symbols that meant nothing to Evangelina, but which he assured her were absolutely vital to the project at hand. And the following cablegram arrived. La Plessise Brion, France. Dear Madame Maston, thought my traveling days were over, but your news has rekindled the only passion still burning in this old man's heart. Pull of Selene too strong for this Endymion, cannot stay away. Passage booked on steamer Nereus, arriving Baltimore, 7th September. Tell Barbicane, explosives problem solved. Explanation on arrival. Ardan. P.S. Sorry husband did not notice new hat. I'm sure it was very lovely. Chapter 7. A Frenchman, a Norwegian, and a cannon. The ladies of the New Park Gardening Society gathered along a railing at the dockside. The new style S-bend corsets beneath their gaily colored outfits contorting their spines into the latest fashionable silhouette. Torso thrust forward as if leaning into a wind. Evangelina stood near the front of the group, feeling rather splendid in her ensemble of leg-of-mutton sleeve dress, white gloves, lace-trimmed parasol, and hat bedecked with silk flowers. A short distance away from the women, a committee of gun club members waited in loose formation, the men almost indistinguishable from one another in their uniform attire of dark frock coats and stovepipe hats. At long last, the ship's passengers began to disembark. The ladies twittered in excitement while the men went through a ritual of solemnly clearing their throats, straightening their backs, and tugging at their waistcoats. A man emerged from the crowd, heading straight for the line of waiting ladies. Tall and broad-shouldered, with weathered skin and a shock of white hair as thick and wild as a lion's mane, he wore no coat nor hat, and was dressed more like a farmhand than a gentleman in his open-necked shirt and trousers, of the coarsest material. Evangelina asked herself if this could possibly be the person she was here to greet, but her doubts were soon dispelled as the men surged forward to shake the oddly dressed stranger's hand and slap him on the back. "Is that him?" she asked Prunella Benton. Prunella nodded, apparently too overcome to speak. And then, before she knew it, the Frenchman was standing before her, taking her gloved hand in his large, calloused paw and raising it to his lips. "My dear Madame Maston, it was your siren call that lured the simple man of the soil away from his little cabbage patch. And now I am, and shall ever remain, your devoted admirer," he said, his dark eyes gazing at her with an intensity that made her feel, for that one moment, as if she was the only woman in the world. "I," she said. "Your husband is the most fortunate of men," Monsieur Ardan told her, before moving on to give his full attention to the next woman down the line. A 40-ish bearded man in a brown wool suit approached the group, followed by at least a dozen stevedores, wheeling an assortment of trunks and crates. "Ah, there you are, at last!" Ardan exclaimed, striding over to the man. He threw an arm around his shoulders and introduced him to the assembled party. "My traveling companion, Professor Stefan Halstein of the University of Christiania." The professor bowed to the assemblage before turning to say something to Ardan. "My friend the professor begs your indulgence as he speaks little English, and asks me to present you with his gift of Norwegian pine cones," Ardan explained, indicating one of the crates. "So, there may be a little bit of Norway on the moon, while I," he went on, touching the crate beside it, "have brought you cabbage seeds from France." The group started to applaud, but Ardan raised a hand for silence. "And herein," he said, denoting the remaining crates and trunks with a sweeping gesture, "lies the solution to the problem of explosives." "What is it?" everyone demanded to know. The Frenchman once again signaled silence. "My friend the professor is a pioneer in the field of electromagnetism. Later, we will organize a demonstration." Evangelina sat in a box at the Baltimore Opera House, which Monsieur Ardan and the Norwegian professor had hired for their demonstration. A row of thick wooden planks and metal sheets hung suspended from the ceiling, above the central aisle, the seats below them cordoned off. On the stage, Michael Ardan and the professor stood either side of a tiny cannon connected to an array of Leyden jars. Professor Halstein spoke in French. Ardan translated his words into English. Ardan said something about coils of wire and electromagnetic forces of attraction and repulsion, none of which she understood, then held up a piece of metal so small she could barely see it. "Please keep in mind, the apparatus we are using today is merely a miniature model, expressly designed for this indoor demonstration, to fire a projectile barely 1 pound in weight. The full-size version of the professor's electromagnetic cannon will not be powered by Leyden jars, but by a steam-driven dynamo the size of this room, and will be capable of firing missiles weighing up to 2 tons, with almost no sound and no recoil." He then went on to talk about the row of targets hanging from the ceiling. "There are 30 of them, 15 metal and 15 wood, none less than 5 inches thick." Ardan handed the piece of metal back to the professor. The professor popped it down the barrel, then threw a switch. Something inside the cannon began to glow bright red. The only sound was a low, deep hum. The professor threw the switch a second time. There was a sudden sound of metal hitting wood, then metal, and then everything went silent once more. The targets were lowered from the ceiling. Every single one had a big round hole through the middle. "But where is the projectile?" someone asked. A search was instigated, which continued until one of the men noticed a hole in the wall at the back of the upper balcony. Everyone hurried upstairs and into the lobby beyond the balcony, where they found a hole punched through to the outside of the building. One of the men looked through and reported seeing a broken window in the top floor of a building across the street. "Tell the professor we need to get started immediately," Mr. Barbicane instructed Ardan. Chapter 8. 2 years later, a new beginning. It was after 11 p.m., but thanks to the array of dynamos thrumming in the night, the crowded streets of Moon City were awash with light. Even the tall cannon looming over the rooftops at the edge of town had been bathed in light for the occasion. And it was to the cannon that everyone was heading. It was the 31st of December, 1899, and the first Earth-to-Moon garbage missile was scheduled for deployment at the stroke of midnight. Evangelina and JT joined the throng, marking their way past rows of vast warehouses, filled with vats of percolating garbage, to the specially erected stands where the Mastons were to have seats of honor alongside Fiona Wick, Monsieur Ardan, and the head of the worm department. By 11:30, everyone was seated and glasses of champagne had been distributed to those in the seats of honor. Monsieur Ardan dabbed at his eyes as the cannon was levered into position. Oh, to be a piece of rubbish inside that capsule! At 1 minute to midnight, Professor Hellstein placed a hand on the switch, and at midnight exactly, he pulled the switch down. There was a brief dimming of the lights, combined with a whooshing sound, and then someone shouted, "There it goes! The first of thousands!" Mr. Barbicane raised his glass of champagne. "To the moon, and a new century." "To the moon, and a new beginning," Fiona said, clinking her glass against his. Monsieur Ardan and the head of the worm department drank a toast to the lovely Celine, soon to turn green, then joined in a chorus of auld lang syne. Evangelina turned to face her husband. "Just think about it, J.T. 100 years from now, people will be living on the moon." J.T. Maston turned his face up to the blackness into which the projectile had vanished, his mind already racing into the future. "When we get home," he said, "I really must dig out that ornamental pond." The end.
Like WSKV-FM on Facebook and let us know where you're listening from.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com with your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey, this is Chris Schaus. Team Kentucky says all gatherings are defined by the CDC as 10 or more people should be canceled or avoided. You can help stop the spread of infection. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
The next story we have tonight is a classic science fiction short story called There Will Come Soft Rains by Ray Bradbury. This is a short, fascinating, if not horrifying story about what happens in the future when a smart house designed to cater to its family suddenly has no family living under its roof anymore, as a result of a nuclear explosion which has left only the smart house standing in a wasteland of fallout. This is a story that makes you think, what will happen to all of our Google Homes or Amazon Alexa devices in the future when the human race is no more? Will all of the world's technology continue to exist without mankind to use it? This is There Will Come Soft Rains by Ray Bradbury. I hope it doesn't unsettle you too much. In the living room, the voice clock sang, "Tick, tock, 7 o'clock, time to get up, 7 o'clock," as if it were afraid that nobody would. The morning house lay empty. The clock ticked on, repeating and repeating its sounds into the emptiness. 7, 9, breakfast time, 7, 9. In the kitchen, the breakfast stove gave a hissing sigh and ejected from its warm interior 8 pieces of perfectly brown toast, 8 eggs, sunny side up, 16 slices of bacon, 2 coffees, and 2 cool glasses of milk. "Today is August 4th, 2026. said a second voice from the kitchen ceiling. "In the city of Allendale, California." It repeated the date 3 times for memory's sake. "Today is Mr. Featherstone's birthday. Today is the anniversary of Tilita's marriage. Insurance is payable, as are the water, gas, and light bills." Somewhere in the walls, relays clicked, memory tapes glided under electric eyes. 8, 1, tick, tock. 8, 1 o'clock, off to school, off to work, run, run, 8, 1. But no doors slammed. No carpets took the soft tread of rubber heels. It was raining outside. The weather box on the front door sang quietly. Rain, rain, go away. Umbrellas, raincoats for today. And the rain tapped on the empty house, echoing. Outside, the garage chimed and lifted its door to reveal the waiting car. After a long wait, the door swung down again. At 8:30, the eggs were shriveled and the toast was like stone. An aluminum wedge scraped them into the sink, where hot water whirled them down a metal throat which digested and flushed them away to the distant sea. The dirty dishes were dropped into a hot washer and emerged twinkling dry. 9:15, sang the clock. Time to clean. Out of Warren's in the wall, tiny robot mice darted. The rooms were a crawl with the small cleaning animals, all rubber and metal. They thudded against chairs, whirling their mustache runners, kneading the rug nap, sucking gently at hidden dust. Then, like mysterious invaders, they popped into their burrows. Their pink electric eyes faded. The house was clean. 10 o'clock. The sun came out from behind the rain. The house stood alone in a city of rubble and ashes. This was the one house left standing. At night, the ruined city gave off a radioactive glow which could be seen for miles. 10:15. The garden sprinklers whirled up in golden founts, filling the soft morning air with scatterings of brightness. The water pelted window panes, running down the charred west side where the house had been burned, evenly free of its white paint. The entire west face of the house was black, save for 5 places. Here, the silhouette and paint of a man mowing a lawn. Here, as in a photograph, a woman bent to pick flowers. Still farther over, their images burned on wood in one titanic instant. A small boy, hands flung into the air. Higher up, the image of a thrown ball. And opposite him, a girl, hands raised to catch a ball which never came down. The 5 spots of paint, the man, the woman, the children, the ball, remained. The rest was a thin, charcoal layer. The gentle sprinkler rain filled the garden with falling light. Until this day, how well the house had kept its peace. How carefully it had inquired, "Who goes there? What's the password?" And, getting no answer from lonely foxes and whining cats, it had shut up its windows and drawn shades in an old, maidenly preoccupation with self-protection which bordered on a mechanical paranoia. It quivered at each sound, the house did. If a sparrow brushed a window, the shade snapped up. The bird, startled, flew off. No, not even a bird must touch the house. 12 noon. A dog whined, shivering, on the front porch. The front door recognized the dog voice and opened. The dog, once huge and fleshy, but now gone to bone and covered with sores, moved in and through the house, tracking mud. Behind it were angry mice, angry at having to pick up mud, angry at inconvenience. For not a leaf fragment blew under the door but what the wall panels flipped open and the copper scrap rats flashed swiftly out. The offending dust, hair, or paper, seized in miniature steel jaws, was raced back to the burrows. There, down tubes which fed into the cellar, it was dropped into the sighing vent of an incinerator, which sat like evil ball in a dark corner. The dog ran upstairs, hysterically yelping to each door, at last realizing, as the house realized, that only silence was here. It sniffed the air and scratched the kitchen door. Behind the door, the stove was making pancakes, which filled the house with a rich, baked odor and the scent of maple syrup. The dog frothed at the mouth, lying at the door, sniffing, its eyes turned to fire. It ran wildly in circles, biting at its tail, spun in a frenzy, and died. It lay in the parlor for an hour. 2 o'clock, sang a voice. Delicately sensing decay at last, the regiments of mice hummed out as softly as blown gray leaves in an electrical wind. 2:15. The dog was gone. In the cellar, the incinerator glowed suddenly, and a whirl of sparks leaped up the chimney. 2:35. Bridge tables sprouted from patio walls. Playing cards fluttered onto pads in a shower of pips. martinis manifested on an oaken bench with egg salad sandwiches. Music played. But the tables were silent and the cards untouched. At 4 o'clock, the tables folded like great butterflies back through the paneled walls. 4:30. The nursery walls glowed. Animals took shape. Yellow giraffes, blue lions, pink antelopes, lilac panthers cavorting in crystal substance. The walls were glass. They looked out upon color and fantasy. Hidden films clucked through well-oiled sprockets, and the walls lived. The nursery floor was woven to resemble a crisp cereal meadow. Over this ran aluminum roaches and iron crickets, and in the hot, still air, butterflies of delicate red tissue wavered among the sharp aroma of animal spores. There was a sound like a great, matted yellow hive of bees within a dark bellows, the lazy bumble of a purring lion, and there was the patter of okapi feet and the murmur of a fresh jungle rain, like other hooves falling upon the summer starch grass. Now the walls dissolved into distances of parched grass, mile on mile, and warm, endless sky. The animals drew away into thorn breaks and water holes. It was the children's hour. 5 o'clock. The bath filled with clear, hot water. 6, 7, 8 o'clock. The dinner dishes manipulated like magic tricks, and in the study, a click. In the metal stand opposite the hearth, where a fire now blazed up warmly, a cigar popped out, half an inch of soft gray ash on it, smoking, waiting. 9 o'clock. The beds warmed their hidden circuits, for nights were cool here. 9:05. A voice spoke from the study ceiling. Mrs. McClellan, which poem would you like this evening? The house was silent. The voice said at last, since you express no preference, I shall select a poem at random. Quiet music rose to back the voice. Sarah Teasdale, as I recall, your favorite. There will come soft rains and the smell of the ground, and swallows circling with their shimmering sound, and frogs in the pools singing at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a low fence wire, and not one will know of the war, not one will care at last when it is done. Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone. The fire burned on the stone hearth, and the cigar fell away into a mound of quiet ash on its tray. The empty chairs faced each other between the silent walls, and the music played. At 10 o'clock, the house began to die. The wind blew. A falling tree bough crashed through the kitchen window. Cleaning solvent, bottled, shattered over the stove. The room was ablaze in an instant. Fire! Screamed a voice. The house lights flashed. Water pumps shot water from the ceilings. But the solvent spread on the linoleum, licking, eating, under the kitchen door, while the voices took it up in chorus. Fire! 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 The house tried to save itself. Doors sprang tightly shut, but the windows were broken by the heat, and the wind blew and sucked upon the fire. The house gave ground as the fire and 10 billion angry sparks moved with flaming ease from room to room and then up the stairs, while scurrying water rats squeaked from the walls, pistoled their water, and ran for more, and the wall sprays let down showers of mechanical rain. But, too late. Somewhere, sighing, a pump shrugged to a stop. The quenching rain ceased. The reserve water supply, which had filled baths and washed dishes for many quiet days, was gone. The fire crackled up the stairs. It fed upon Picassos and Matisses in the upper halls, like delicacies, baking off the oily flesh, tenderly crisping the canvases into black shavings. Now the fire lay in beds, stood in windows, changed the colors of drapes. And then, reinforcements. From attic trapdoors, blind robot faces peered down with faucet mouths, gushing green chemical. The fire backed off, as even an elephant must at the sight of a dead snake. Now there were 20 snakes whipping over the floor, killing the fire with a clear, cold venom of green froth. But the fire was clever. It had sent flame outside the house, up through the attic to the pumps there. An explosion. The attic brain which directed the pumps was shattered into bronze shrapnel on the beams. The fire rushed back into every closet, and felt of the clothes hung there. The house shuddered, oak bone on bone, its bared skeleton cringing from the heat, its wire, its nerves revealed as if a surgeon had torn the skin off to let the red veins and capillaries quiver in the scalded air. "Help! Help! Fire! Run! Run!" Heat snapped mirrors like the first brittle winter ice, and the voices wailed. "Fire! Fire! Run! Run!" Like a tragic nursery rhyme, a dozen voices, high, low, like children dying in a forest, alone, alone. And the voices fading as the wires popped their sheathings like hot chestnuts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 voices died. In the nursery, the jungle burned. Blue lions roared. Purple giraffes bounded off. The panthers ran in circles, changing color, and 10 million animals, running before the fire, vanished off toward a distant, steaming river. 10 more voices died. In the last instant, under the fire avalanche, other choruses, oblivious, could be heard announcing the time. Cutting the lawn by remote-control mower, or setting an umbrella frantically out and in. The slamming and opening front door. 1,000 things happening, like a clock shop when each clock strikes the hour insanely before or after the other. A scene of maniac confusion, yet unity. Singing, screaming. A few last cleaning mice darting bravely out to carry the horrid ashes away. And one voice, with sublime disregard for the situation, read poetry aloud in the fiery study, until all the film spools burned, until all the wires withered and the circuits cracked. The fire burst the house and let it slam flat down, puffing out skirts of spark and smoke. In the kitchen, an instant before the rain of fire and timber, the stove could be seen making breakfast at a psychopathic rate. 10 dozen eggs, 6 loaves of toast, 20 dozen bacon strips, which, eaten by fire, started the stove working again, hysterically hissing. The crash. The attic smashing into kitchen and parlor. The parlor into cellar. Cellar into sub-cellar. Deep freeze, armchair, film tapes, circuits, beds, and all like skeletons thrown in a cluttered mound deep under. Smoke and silence. A great quantity of smoke. Dawn showed faintly in the east. Among the ruins, one wall stood alone. Within the wall, a last voice said, over and over again and again, even as the sun rose to shine upon the heaped rubble and steam. Today is August 5th, 2026. Today is August 5th, 2026. Today is the end. This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library. All checkout dates have been extended until further notice, and there will be no late fees on any account at this time. As the library works toward its reopening date, you can expect our book drop service to return soon, as well as our new innovative curbside service. For more information about these services and the innovative programs we offer, keep an eye on the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page for any and all updates. Free Wi-Fi is still offered at the Powell County Public Library, which is located by Stanton Elementary. To access this Wi-Fi from the comfort of your vehicle, just select the network Public Library Wireless and use the free Wi-Fi password, PCPLKY65. Free Wi-Fi is also provided at the stationary bookmobile, which is in its new location at Clay City Elementary. To take advantage of the bookmobile Wi-Fi, just sign on to the network Bookmobile Wireless and use the same password from the main library, which is PCPLKY65. Flyers containing all of this information are posted on the doors of the main library and on the bookmobile for reference. Although the library isn't open to the public just yet, you can still check out our online catalog by going to the Powell County Public Library's website at pcplky.org to see everything our digital collection has to offer. And you can check out digital library books, audiobooks, and magazines with the free Libby or OverDrive apps in the Google Play or App Store. All you need is the barcode number on the back of your library card to have access to thousands of ebooks and digital materials. For any questions, just message the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page or send the library an email at info@pcplky.org. The staff of the Powell County Public Library encourages the community to continue practicing safe social distancing methods as our community opens back up so that we can all be a part of Team Kentucky.
Hey, this is Rachel Crow. The Kentucky Department of Health and Family Services say nursing homes and other long-term care providers are advised to restrict access to visitors and consult CDC guidelines for long-term care facilities. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
So, to step away from the grimness of our last story, we'll be turning to a fantasy story next that can be enjoyed by all ages. The Smallest Dragon Boy, by fantasy author pioneer Anne McCaffrey, is a charming coming-of-age tale about a young boy named Kevin, and his experience with finally being of age to become a dragon rider. But in the world of Pern, where this story takes place, the dragon has to choose the rider. Kevin is hopeful, but small and meek, and is bullied by the other young teens for his stature. Will Kevin be able to overcome his bullies and realize his hidden strengths and determination? Will he be chosen by a dragon and take one step closer to adulthood? This is a story where you'll be rooting for the main character all the way to the end. This is The Smallest Dragon Boy by Anne McCaffrey. Although Kevin lengthened his walking stride as far as his legs would stretch, he couldn't quite keep up with the other candidates. He knew he would be teased again. Just as he knew many other things that his foster mother told him he ought not to know, Kevin knew that Betterly, the most senior of the boys, set that spanking pace just to embarrass him, the smallest dragon boy. Kevin would arrive, tail fork end of the group, breathless, chest heaving, and maybe get a stem look from the instructing wing second. Dragon riders, even if they were still only hopeful candidates for the glowing eggs which were hardening on the hot sands of the hatching ground cavern, were expected to be punctual and prepared. Sloth was not tolerated by the were-leader of Benden Were. A good record was especially important now. It was very near hatching time when the baby dragons would crack their mottled shells and stagger forth to choose their lifetime companions. The very thought of that glorious moment made Kevin's breath catch in his throat. To be chosen, to be a dragon rider, to sit astride the neck of a winged beast with jeweled eyes, to be his friend in telepathic communion with him for life, to be his companion in good times and fighting extremes, to fly effortlessly over the lands of Pern, or, thrillingly, between to any point anywhere on the world. Flying between was done on dragonback, or not at all, and it was dangerous. Kevin glanced upward, past the black mouths of the were-caves in which grown dragons and their chosen riders lived, toward the starstones that crowned the ridge of the old volcano that was Benden Were. On the height, the Blue Watch dragon, his rider mounted on his neck, stretched the great transparent pinions that carried him on the winds of Pern to fight the evil thread that fell at certain times from the skies. The many-faceted rainbow jewels of his eyes glistened fleetingly in the greeny sun. He folded his great wings to his back, and the watch pair resumed their statue-like pose of alertness. Then, the enticing view was obscured as Kevin passed into the hatching ground cavern. The sands underfoot were hot, even through heavy were-hide boots. How the bootmaker had protested having to sew so small. Kevin was forced to wonder why being small was reprehensible. People were always calling him babe and shooing him away as being too small or too young for this or that. Kevin was constantly working twice as hard as any other boy his age to prove himself capable. What if his muscles weren't as big as Betterly's? They were just as hard, and if he couldn't overpower anyone in a wrestling match, he could outdistance everyone in a foot race. Maybe if you run fast enough, Betterly had jeered on the occasion when Kevin had been goaded to boast on his swiftness. You could catch a dragon. That's the only way you'll make a dragon rider. You just wait and see, Betterly. You just wait, Keevan had replied. He would have liked to wipe the contemptuous smile from Betterly's face, but the guy didn't fight fair even when a wing second was watching. No one knows what impresses a dragon. They've got to be able to find you first, babe. Yes, being the smallest candidate was not an enviable position. It was therefore imperative that Keevan impress a dragon in his first hatching. That would wipe the smile off every face in the cavern, and accord him the respect due any dragon rider, even the smallest one. Besides, no one knew exactly what impressed the baby dragons as they struggled from their shells in search of their lifetime partners. I like to believe that dragons see into a man's heart, Keevan's foster mother, Mende, told him. If they find goodness, honesty, a flexible mind, patience, courage, and you've got that in quantity, dear Keevan, that's what dragons look for. I've seen many a well-grown lad left standing on the sands, hatching day, in favor of someone not so strong or tall or handsome. And if my memory serves me, which it usually did, Mende knew every word of Harper's tale worth telling, although Keevan did not interrupt her to say so. I don't believe that Falar, our wear leader, was all that tall when Bronze Nemmanth chose him, and Nemmanth was the only bronze dragon of that hatching. Dreams of impressing a bronze were beyond Keevan's boldest reflections, although that goal dominated the thoughts of every other hopeful candidate. Green dragons were small and fast and more numerous. There is more prestige to impressing a blue or brown than a green. Being practical, Keevan seldom dreamed as high as a big, fighting brown, like Canth, Fëanor's fine fellow, the biggest brown on all Pern. But to fly a bronze? Bronzes were almost as big as the queen, and only they took the air when a queen flew at mating time. A bronze rider could aspire to become wear leader. Well, Keevan would console himself. Brown riders could aspire to become wing seconds, and that wasn't bad. He'd even settle for a green dragon. They were small, but so was he. No matter. He simply had to impress a dragon his first time in the hatching ground. Then, no one in the wear would taunt him anymore for being so small. Shells, Keevan thought now, but the sands are hot. Impression time is imminent, candidates, the wing second was saying as everyone crowded respectfully close to him. See the extent of the striations on this promising egg. The stretch marks were larger than yesterday. Everyone leaned forward and nodded thoughtfully. That particular egg was the one Betterly had marked as his own, and no other candidate dared, on pain of being beaten by Betterly at his first opportunity, to approach it. The egg was marked by a large, yellowish splotch in the shape of a dragon back winging to land, talons outstretched to grasp rock. Everyone knew that bronze eggs bore distinctive markings, and, naturally, Betterly, who'd been presented at 8 impressions already and was the biggest of the candidates, had chosen it. I'd say that the great opening day is almost upon us, the wing second went on, and then his face assumed a grave expression. As we well know, there are only 40 eggs and 72 candidates. Some of you may be disappointed on the great day. That doesn't necessarily mean you aren't a dragon rider material, just that the dragon for you hasn't been shelled. You'll have other hatchings, and it's no disgrace to be left behind an impression or two, or more. Keevan was positive that the wing second's eyes rested on Betterly, who'd been stood off at so many impressions already. Keevan tried to squinch down so the wing second wouldn't notice him. Keevan had been reminded too often that he was eligible to be a candidate by one day only. He, of all the hopefuls, was most likely to be left standing on the great day. One more reason why he simply had to impress at his first hatching. Now, move about among the eggs, the wing second said. Touch them. We don't know if that does any good, but it certainly doesn't do any harm. Some of the boys laughed nervously, but everyone immediately began to circulate among the eggs. Betterly stepped up officiously to his egg, daring anyone to come near it. Keevan smiled, because he had already touched it. Every inspection day, when the others were leaving the hatching ground and no one could see him crouch to stroke it. Kevin had an egg he concentrated on, too, one drawn slightly to the far side of the others. The shell had a soft, greenish-blue tinge with a faint, creamy swirl design. The consensus was that this egg contained a mere green, so Kevin was rarely bothered by rivals. He was somewhat perturbed then to see Betterly wandering over to him. "I don't know why you're allowed in this impression, Kevin. There are enough of us without a babe," Betterly said, shaking his head. "I'm of age." Kevin kept his voice level, telling himself not to be bothered by mere words. "Yeah," Betterly made a show of standing in his toe tips. "You can't even see over an egg. Hatching day, you better get in front or the dragons won't see you at all. Course, you could get run down that way in the mad scramble. Oh, I forget. You can run fast, can't you?" "You'd better make sure a dragon sees you this time, Betterly," Kevin replied. "You're almost over age, aren't you?" Betterly flushed and took a step forward, hand half raised. Kevin stood his ground, but if Betterly advanced one more step, he would call the wing second. No one fought on the hatching ground. Surely Betterly knew that much. Fortunately, at that moment, the wing second called the boys together and led them from the hatching ground to start on evening chores. There were glows to be replenished in the main kitchen caverns and sleeping cubicles, the major hallways, and the queen's apartment. Firestone sacks had to be filled against thread attack, and black rock brought to the kitchen hearths. The boys fell to their chores, tantalized by the odors of roasting meat. The population of the Weir began to assemble for the evening meal, and the dragon riders came in from the feeding ground on their sweet checks. It was the time of day Kevin liked best. Once the chores were done, but before dinner was served, a fellow could often get close enough to the dragon riders to hear their talk. Tonight, Kevin's father, Kalast, was at the main dragon rider table. It puzzled Kevin how his father, a brown rider and a tall man, could be his father, because he, Kevin, was so small. It obviously puzzled Kalast, too, when he deigned to notice his small son. "In a few more turns, you'll be as tall as I am. Or taller." Kalast was pouring Benden wine all around the table. The dragon riders were relaxing. There'd be no threat attack for 3 more days, and they'd be in the mood to tell tall tales, better than Harper yarns, about impossible maneuvers they'd done a dragon back. When threat attack was closer, their talk would change to discussion of tactics of evasion, of going between, how long to suspend there until the burning but fragile thread would freeze and crack and fall harmlessly off dragon and man. They would dispute the exact moment to feed Firestone to the dragon so he'd have the best flame ready to sear thread mid-air and render it harmless to ground and man below. There was such a lot to know and understand about being a dragon rider that sometimes Kevin was overwhelmed. How would he ever be able to remember everything he ought to know at the right moment? He couldn't dare ask such a question. This would only have given additional weight to the notion that he was too young yet to be a dragon rider. "Having older candidates makes good sense," Lavelle was saying, as Kevin settled down near the table. "Why waste 4 to 5 years of a dragon's fighting prime until his rider grows up enough to stand the rigors?" Lavelle had impressed a blue of Ramoth's first clutch. Most of the candidates thought Lavelle was marvelous because he spoke up in front of the older riders, who awed them. That was well enough in the interval when you didn't need to mount the full Weir complement to fight Thread. But not now. Not with more eligible candidates than ever. Let the babes wait. "Any boy who is over 12 turns has the right to stand in the hatching ground," Kalest replied, a slight smile on his face. He never argued or got angry. Kevin wished he were more like his father. And oh, how he wished he were a brown rider. Only a dragon, each particular dragon, knows what he wants in a rider. We certainly can't tell. Time and again, the theorists, Kalest's smile deepened as his eyes swept those at the table, are surprised by dragon choice. They never seem to make mistakes, however. And we'll be back with more right after this.
Pickup Country, WSKV 104.9.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com
with your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey, this is Hannah Wheeler. You can help stop the spread of germs by practicing social distancing, staying about 6 feet from others, especially those who are sick. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
Preset us on your radio.
104.9 Pickup Country.
This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library. All checkout dates have been extended until further notice, and there will be no late fees on any account at this time. As the library works towards its reopening date, you can expect our book drop service to return soon, as well as our new innovative curbside service. For more information about these services and the innovative programs we offer, keep an eye on the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page for any and all updates. Free Wi-Fi is still offered at the Powell County Public Library, which is located by Stanton Elementary. To access this Wi-Fi from the comfort of your vehicle, just select the network Public Library Wireless and use the free Wi-Fi password PCPLKY65. Free Wi-Fi is also provided at the stationary bookmobile, which is in its new location at the Clay City Elementary. To take advantage of the bookmobile Wi-Fi, just sign on to the network Bookmobile Wireless and use the same password for the main library, which is PCPLKY65. Flyers containing all of this information are posted on the doors of the main library and on the bookmobile for reference. Although the library isn't open to the public yet, you can still check out our online catalog by going to the Powell County Public Library's website at pcplky.org to see everything our digital collection has to offer. And you can check out digital library books, audiobooks, and magazines with the free Libby or OverDrive apps in the Google Play or App Store. All you need is the barcode number on the back of your library card to have access to thousands of ebooks and digital materials. For any questions, just message the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page or send the library an email at info@pcplky.org. The staff of the Powell County Public Library encourages the community to continue practicing safe and social distancing methods as our community opens back up so that we can all be a part of Team Kentucky.
Hey, this is Anna Klein.
And John Lenny.
We're Grits and Soul. You can help stop the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Please avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth.
If you wear a mask, bandana, or scarf to cover your face, be sure to cover your nose and mouth.
Be cautious about touching your face while adjusting it throughout the day, and wash your hands regularly or wear gloves to prevent further spreading of germs. Stay well. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
Now, Calast, just look at the roster this impression. 72 boys and only 40 eggs. Drop off the 12 youngest and there's still a good field for the hatchlings to choose from. Shells, there are a couple of werelings unable to see over a were egg, much less a dragon, and years before they can ride thread. True enough. But the were is scarcely under fighting strength, and if the youngest impress, they'll be old enough to fight when the oldest of our current dragons go between from senility. Half the were-bred lads have already been through several impressions, one of the bronze riders said then. I'd say drop some of them off this time. Give the untried a chance. There's nothing wrong in presenting a clutch with as wide a choice as possible, said the were-leader, who had joined the table with Lessa, the were-woman. Has there ever been a case, she said, smiling in her odd way at the riders, where a hatchling didn't choose? Her suggestion was almost heretical and drew astonished gasps from everyone, including the boys. Falar laughed. You say the most outrageous things, Lessa. Well, has there ever been a case where a dragon didn't choose? Can't say as I recall one, Calast replied. Then we continue in this tradition, Lessa said firmly, as if that ended the matter. But it didn't. The arguments ranged from one table to the other all through dinner, with some favoring a weeding out of the candidates to the most likely, lopping off those who were very young or who had had multiple opportunities to impress. All the candidates were in a swivet, though such a departure from tradition would be to the advantage of many. As the evening progressed, more riders were favoring eliminating the youngest and those who'd passed four or more impressions unchosen. Kevin felt he could bear such a dictum only if Betterly were also eliminated. But this seemed less likely than that Kevin would be turfed out, since the wearer's need was for fighting dragons and riders. By the time the evening meal was over, no decision had been reached, although the wearer leader had promised to give the matter due consideration. He might have slept on the problem, but few of the candidates did. Tempers were uncertain in the sleeping caverns next morning as the boys were routed out of their beds to carry water and black rock and cover the glows. Twice Mende had to call Kevin to order for clumsiness. "Whatever is the matter with you, boy?" she demanded in exasperation when he tipped black rock short of the bin and suited up the hearth. "They're going to keep me from this impression." "What?" Mende stared at him. "Who?" "You heard them talking at dinner last night. They're going to turf the babes from the hatching." Mende regarded him a moment longer before touching his arm gently. "There's lots of talk around a supper table, Kevin, and it cools as soon as the supper. I've heard the same nonsense before every hatching, but nothing has ever changed." "There's always a first time," Kevin answered, copying one of her own phrases. "That'll be enough of that, Kevin. Finish your job. If the clutch does hatch today, we'll need full rock bins for the feast, and you won't be around to do the filling. All my fosterlings make dragon riders." "The first time?" Kevin was bold enough to ask as he scooted off with the rock barrel. Perhaps, Kevin thought later, if he hadn't been on that chore just when Betterly was also fetching black rock, things might have turned out differently. But he had dutifully trundled the barrow to the outdoor bunker for another load, just as Betterly arrived on a similar errand. So, we're going to end the story here for tonight. And since I won't be here next Thursday, I'll see you guys on August 6th. Have a good night.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight for our Pick Me a Story series, right here on your hometown station, Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV. If you missed tonight's segment, you can always listen on demand at listenlikealocal.com with your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store and on Apple Podcast. If you enjoyed tonight's show, be sure to tune in next Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and join me for the next installment of Pick Me a Story. My name is Kelly Ward and I'm the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library, and it's my pleasure to share stories with the community during this time when we should all be staying healthy at home and practicing social distancing methods. If you have any recommendations for what books we should explore next, just send me an email at kward@pcplky.org. That's kward@pcplky.org. Don't forget to tune in next week on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, online at listenlikealocal.com, or with the free WSKV app for our next installment of Pick Me a Story. Be safe and have a wonderful rest of your evening.